I think this conference is an opportunity to foster the interaction between female scholars and to strengthen our network. Men are pretty good at that. We are not, and we'd better improve.
Hello, and welcome to Stephanomics, the podcast that brings the global economy to you. Now, I've recently done something I've never done before, and I thought it was worth sharing for this week's podcast. I sat down with three senior policymakers to talk about how central banking could make the world a better place. And the senior policymakers in question were all women. That panel was part of a special conference on macroeconomics and finance co-sponsored by the European Central Bank and the European think tank, the Centre for Economic Policy Research. And it wasn't so different from other academic conferences I've been to. Interesting cutting-edge papers on topics like the impact of monetary policy on racial inequality, or whether low interest rates make the economy less efficient. Well, they were interesting to me anyway. The only thing that was different about this super brainy conference was that every single one of the contributing speakers was a woman. Now, you might not think this kind of statement, women's conference, was really necessary in this day and age. Don't you find senior women economists popping up all over the place? But you'd be wrong, as the president of the European Central Bank, Christine Lagarde, explained when she launched the event.
The 2020 report published by the American Economic Association shows that women make up only 25% of the PhD-granting economics faculties in the United States. And most of those women do not hold tenure-track positions, and the share of female full professors is only 15%. In Europe, and it is estimated that the figures that we have at the moment actually decrease to 12% when considering top research institutions and more senior positions. So it's not a very rosy picture, despite sometimes the impression that we have that a lot of progress has been made. No, and these gender imbalances need to be addressed. Broadening women's participation in the economics profession and removing the obstacles they face pursuing a career is not just a matter of fairness, which in and of itself would be sufficient. But it's also needed because preventing women from participating and achieving leadership roles is just detrimental to society as a whole. There have been multiple studies pointing to that. A recent one by the International Monetary Fund, of course, found that the presence of women on the boards of financial and supervisory institutions was associated with greater resilience, less risk-taking, and increased stability. Now, maybe we don't want any of that, but I have my hunch that maybe we want stability, maybe we want a bit less risk-taking, and maybe we desire greater resilience. And that is the reason why it is so important to have events like today's conference, not just to advocate and identify obstacles, as I have just done, but to show that we mean business. And the research that we conduct and the policies that we recommend and the analytical work that is behind it is of superb quality and will demonstrate perfectly that of course we can do it and of course we mean business.
Now, as I said, most of the conference was a bit technical, but that panel I hosted at the end of the first day was on a subject everyone ought to care about: the social responsibilities of central banks. And the lineup, well, it doesn't get much better. You can judge for yourself in this edited version of our conversation. Enjoy. After this great day of academic and path-breaking discussion, we have a big topic to discuss: how central banks can support a new social contract. Now, I'm conscious that some would say, maybe many would say, that the best way for central banks to support a new social contract is to keep well clear and to focus just on their knitting, on controlling inflation and letting politicians worry about things like society, because that's what politicians are elected to do. And if our conception of a better social contract in this discussion is going to also include an effective response to climate change, which I suspect it will, I think there are many people who have been who have said that central banks should keep well clear of that too. But if we've learned anything, especially in the response to the global financial crisis and the pandemic, it's that central bank policies can have very big social and political consequences, whether we like it or not. We'll be talking about all of this and much more in this session. So let me get on with introducing them and we can get started. Dr. Isabel Schnabel has been a member of the European Central Bank's Executive Board for since the start of 2020. She's also been a member of the German Council of Economic Experts and I think is still a professor of financial economics at the University of Bonn. Baroness Minouche Shafik is now director of the London School of Economics, having more or less run out of senior policy jobs to do. Before that, she'd served as a deputy governor of the Bank of England, a senior civil servant at the International Department of International Development in the UK, and a senior official at both the IMF and the World Bank. She also just happens to have written a book, What We Owe Each Other, A New Social Contract, recently, which I suspect will come up in this discussion. And finally, we have Dr. Carmen Reinhart, very well known to everybody here, I know, chief economist of the World Bank since last year and currently on leave from her position as professor of the international financial system at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Ladies, welcome. So glad to be here. Minouche Shafik.
Thank you so much, Stephanie. The core mandate of central banks and the best thing we can do for the social contract is to deliver both price and financial stability, because we all know that episodes of high inflation hurt the poor the most, and we've seen that in many, many countries. And so, and similarly with episodes of financial instability, because they have the fewest tools to insure themselves and protect themselves from those shocks. But I also think that central banks need to be aware of the social consequences of their policies and also be aware of how social policies affect central banking. And let me just give two examples. On the first point, how their policies affect social and political consequences, there's been a huge debate, as we all know, around how recent fairly aggressive monetary policies and quantitative easing have affected income distribution. And there's been quite a lot written in central banking circles around that. Now, we know that the effect of monetary policy on income distribution is complex and operates through multiple channels. Lower income households are more likely to lose their jobs during recessions. And so looser monetary policy is likely to increase employment and be good for them. On the other hand, richer households tend to have more assets and are likely to benefit from looser monetary policies through the asset price channel. And so the net effect is an empirical question, and it can vary across countries and across times. Now, I don't think central banks should be setting monetary policy with a view to altering income distribution, which is a deeply political thing and should be left in the hands of elected politicians, as Stephanie implied in her introduction. But central banks should be aware of the consequences of monetary policy for income and wealth, and collect data on these impacts and provide analysis to the fiscal authorities so that they are well informed and, if necessary, can act on that information. They should be paying attention to whether their policies have different impacts on different groups, like women or different parts of a country. And again, not to alter their policies, but to inform those whose mandate it is to worry about those issues, about the potential consequences. Let me give an example of the opposite point, which is, how do social and political policies affect central banking? One of the most important debates we're having these days is, you know, why are the debate about secular stagnation? Now, we know interest rates are have been at historic lows because global savings is high relative to global investment. And why are global savings high? Because people face insecurity and populations are aging, which is why, of course, interest rates are lowest in the parts of the world that are aging the most, like Japan and Europe. And this results in a tendency to hoard savings, which reduces demand for goods and services and slows rates of economic growth. Now, if we had better social insurance, we could reduce this risk of secular stagnation. So, for example, Chinese households save about 30 to 40% of their incomes, in part because until recently, they didn't have unemployment insurance or health insurance or reliable pensions. And so as social insurance is increasingly introduced in China, those really high savings rates could come down. And on the other side of the equation, investment is very low because governments haven't created an environment where firms see good opportunities to grow. But many elements of the social contract, such as more investment in education or infrastructure to reduce carbon emissions, could actually increase demand, especially in developing countries where profitable opportunities exist if risks can be reduced. And so the problem of secular stagnation is not one that central bankers and monetary policy can solve, but a better social contract could. And so central bankers should be happy to see policies like social insurance or support to families and education or green investment incentives, because they help reduce the need for precautionary savings, they increase the level of global investment, and they help us avoid the risks of secular stagnation. So I would close that.
Carmen Reinhart.
Thank you, Stephanie, and thank you for the organizers to invite me to this wonderful event. I also have to say that we are well past the view where, you know, central bankers are these suit-clad men that we have typically associated with central banking, very much thanks to Janet Yellen and Madame Lagarde, and of course many others around the world. I do want to echo very much what Minouche pointed out on the importance of not shortchanging the mandate of price stability. One thing that hasn't been mentioned in the panel is that headline inflation does grab, that's why it's called headline, the attention of the public. But at the very near nitty-gritty level, food price inflation, which usually exceeds headline inflation, in effect, relative food prices tend to increase disproportionately. So we can't lose sight that inflation as a whole is extremely regressive. It is regressive for many of the reasons that the panelists have pointed out, but I would add that the food dimension is critical. I would stress that an important part of that social contract is ensuring that the price stability that has been achieved in central banks, that we should not at any moment lose sight of that mandate. I would also add that, unfortunately, for all of us who are economists, economists don't have a great track record in predicting turning points. And I think we are at a very tough spot here. On one hand, you have the concerns that premature tightening would undermine a recovery from the worst hit that the global economy, to my knowledge, has seen. We're coming out of a very exceptional period. So there's the concerns of undermining the recovery. But at the same time, US inflation rates are at a 30-year high. If you look at consumer prices and if you look at producer prices, they're at a 40-year high. And the concern of acting too late, too little and too late, is a very real one. Is a very real one. In the aftermath of 2008-2009, we were, especially in the advanced economies, not so in the emerging markets, we were confronted with massive aggregate demand declines. In the current context, fast forward to COVID, we are both dealing with exceptional declines in aggregate demands, but also all manner of aggregate supply shocks. So, and a lesson from the 1970s that was that central banks' ability to stabilize economic activity in the face of supply shocks is much, much, much to be questioned. It's much more limited. So we also have the danger, I said, we have the danger of reacting prematurely, and the danger of acting too little and too late. So it's, and if that trade-off is not an enviable one in the advanced economies, it's even steeper in the developed world, in developing world, where we've already seen a number of central banks do a very aggressive rate hikes, and not coincidentally, it very much relates to the social unrest that countries like Brazil are seeing over what are spiraling food and energy crises. I do have the concern that if we continue to view this as a very transient feature, that response may indeed mimic some of the errors we saw in the 1970s. Let me stop there.
Thank you, Carmen. Dr. Isabel Schnabel.
I think this will be the debate that we are going to have going forward. I mean, in the over this past decade, where inflation was always below the target, we basically, I mean, we were facing shocks both on the supply and on the demand side that were more deflationary. But it may actually be that we are, that this is now changing. And one reason why it is changing is actually the green transition. And I mean, if you think about something like carbon prices, you can of course think of it as like supply side shocks. And we will have many of those going forward, again and again and again and again. And then the question comes up, what are we going to do about it? Can we say that we are just going to look through all of that, even though, of course, it does reduce the purchasing power of people? And this is a very difficult topic. I think we need much more research on that. It's an open question, but these are very difficult questions. And I think there's not yet a good answer to that.
Our economists have just done some research into this, which talks about the likelihood of more and more shocks to inflation, but also the inflationary impact of just moving to a higher carbon price. You know, there's a straightforward impact of that. And then there's, as you say, the potential for a lot more variability of inflation and supply side shocks on either side. Minusha, when you were talking earlier and you were talking about the importance of the central bank flagging up the potentially unequal impact of its policies in this in various ways, I guess I was wondering, okay, but what do you do if you haven't got a well-behaved government, if you haven't got a government that actually responds to any of your careful explanations of what they might want to do to correct the impact of your policies? And if you have a government that isn't putting in place a good environment for climate, for investment, and isn't discouraging people from doing lots of precautionary savings by having good social safety nets. So what a central bank supposed to just wash their hands at that point?
Well, I think it goes in two steps. I mean, I think, you know, the first step is you share the analysis with the government. And I think most of us who've been in central banks know that central banks tend to be slightly better resourced than ministries of finance. And they have...
Don't tell anyone.
They have deeper analytical capacity than ministries of finance. And I think those initial, that first step can be done behind closed doors and saying, here's what our analysis shows is happening to income distribution. This is what our analysis shows is happening to food prices and what that means for certain types of households or certain parts of the country. And giving elected political leaders at least the information so that they can't say, oh, we didn't know that this was happening. I think that's step one. I think step two, if, as you say, Stephanie, there is a government that's actually unwilling to act, I don't think that should change central banks' adherence to their mandates. And they should suddenly say, aha, we will be the white knight who will resolve the income distributional or climate change consequences. But I do think, you know, there have been many brave central bankers in recent years who've gone public with some of this kind of analysis. And simply just by putting it in the public domain, but not necessarily acting on it, I think can be quite powerful. And so that's what I would argue should be done in cases where governments are unwilling to deal with some of these wider consequences.
I actually had this comment already when I heard Nus very nice remarks. I actually think we have to go, as central banks, we have to go a bit beyond what she said. So I think it's not enough to simply tell governments, oh, so you see here, there's a distributional problem, please do something about it. So I don't think that's enough because, of course, we do have some leeway, what we do precisely. So we have leeway, which tools to use. And if we know that, that certain tools have stronger distributional consequences than others, that may be an argument for using one tool and not the other. Similarly, it may actually affect the calibration of our tool. So, for example, I mean, in our strategy, we have this concept of the medium term, which gives us a bit of flexibility regarding the question. And one other point I would like to stress is that, of course, one cannot take the position that central banks should not care at all about distributional effects because, I mean, these distributional effects are, of course, there, and the way we act does have these effects. So we are never neutral, and I think we cannot ignore that. But we have to raise awareness of that, and have to be honest about that.
Hélène has a great question, which I think, because we're not going to end up with that much time, but I'm interested to what any of you think about it. So she suggests that central banks seem like it's a policy success, you know, that we've had these institutions that we made independent and that made policy better, and they were able to look through the political cycle and cooperate with one another to achieve global objectives. Should we be looking to reproduce that model for other crucial public goods, like not least, you know, getting an effective carbon price? And she suggests maybe having independent carbon councils for setting carbon prices. I just wonder, I mean, even if we don't think there could necessarily be a global carbon council tomorrow, unless COP26 does something very interesting. Do we think there's other areas of public policy that we should be following the central bank model? Manoush, maybe?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. There are some domains in which it's been possible to depoliticize aspects of decision-making. And central banks are a really good example. Many countries have independent fiscal councils now, which, independent of the finance ministry, assess the budget and report on fiscal policy in a neutral way. There's about 40 or 50 of them now spread around the world.
In the US, they have the base closure permission.
Oh, yes, base closure commission. That's right. That would take a neutral view. In some countries, the definition of voting districts is done by an independent entity that does it on a scientific basis to depoliticize it. I mean, you know, as a lifelong technocrat, I have a lot of sympathy with these kind of approaches because it you know, makes decisions on a rational basis. It does all the things that Hélène says in her question, which is it's, you know, rational, accountable, independent, etc. So I would love to see more aspects of government policy being subjected to that kind of rigor. But the truth is, we're in a moment of kind of nationalism and populism and increasing, you know, wearing a mask has become political. And so it feels like we're not at a moment when taking things out of the political realm seems very likely. But I do think we need to keep thinking about where those opportunities are. And maybe you're right. Maybe carbon is the next place where thinking about, just as an example, you know, one of the biggest issues with carbon markets is that there is complete inconsistency in the way that carbon credits, offsets, emissions trading, it's the Wild West. I mean, I know this personally because the LSE just announced that we're the first carbon neutral university in the UK. But when we went to try and buy carbon credits, it was the Wild West. I mean, it was completely unregulated, and we had to work really hard. And that might be an area where, for example, independent entities could be created to do verification. At the moment, there's a proliferation of lots of little NGOs that do this. But if we're going to have a serious carbon market and financial institutions are going to have to verify this stuff, maybe we need an independent entity that isn't the central bank, but looks like an independent institution that would enable that market to function. And maybe there's enough political support that we might actually get it in that domain, even though we can't get it in others.
So the environmental equivalent of the generally accepted accounting principles, which
exactly.
I think many people would say had made a played a very big role in sort
exactly.
of global capitalism, right. globalization. Carmen or Isabel, what do you think about this suggestion?
Well, let me say that a concern that I have at the moment is that the pendulum actually is swinging in the other direction. Central bank independence was a really big movement. It really took, of course, root first in the advanced economy and then spread to the emerging markets and developing countries. So my concern in response to Helene's question is that in this more politicized environment, much more bimodal views, if you will, the pendulum is actually, unfortunately, moving in the opposite direction.
I wanted to sort of go back to this question of distributional consequences, but it relates to some of the things that we were saying about the changing political climate. People are blaming central bank policy for penalizing savers and increasing wealth inequality. And many populist leaders are making central bank scapegoats for, you know, in their arguments against the current system. So I guess I want to, you know, if we stick with this line that you can't really intervene on the distributional front, you can only kind of urge and explain, is there a risk that you'll be sort of damned either way, you know, because you'll be considered to have had all of these negative political implications and your independence is compromised by that, maybe even taken away because you didn't act on the distributional consequences? Isabel.
So let me say first that, of course, it starts with communication. So communication is extremely important. We often see that people don't understand what we are doing. And this is not just people who are not very well educated in economic terms, but it's even leading politicians who don't understand what we are doing. And there, the first thing, of course, we have to do is to explain as much as we can in a language that people understand. And I mean, this is something we have to deliver. We cannot ask them to first get an economics PhD, but we have to explain it so that people understand it. Then I think we have to be honest about the side effects of our policies, and we have to be able to explain why we believe that the benefits are larger than the costs. If we cannot say that, then probably we shouldn't follow those policies. So, and that of course means we have to do this analysis. I mean, that's of course also something that we have to do. But the problem is that there are times when all of this is even more complicated. And I think we are in such a time now. So for quite some time, we have been arguing, okay, our instruments have all these side effects, but see, inflation is so low, we have to do it. But now what people are seeing is, so they're still doing all those things. The side effects are getting maybe even bigger, but inflation is at 5% or it's approaching 5%. So, and that becomes extremely difficult. And I still don't know how to solve that problem. But I mean, this is kind of the situation that we are facing now. And that indeed then also poses a threat to our independence, because we do see that many politicians now speak up and say, are they still following their mandate or not? And we have to keep that in mind.
Minush, risks to central banks. Do you think they're in this perilous position that actually in different ways Carmen and Isabel have described, slightly different ways?
I think the dangers are greatest in some of the emerging markets that Carmen identified in terms of risk to central bank independence. In the wake of COVID, many emerging market central banks did things like QE that they had never done before and adopted policies that were being used from the advanced economies. And in some of those cases, the arguments that this was fiscal dominance, I think, is kind of compelling, actually. It did look an awful lot like fiscal dominance in some countries, and that's worrying. And that's sort of a step in the direction of eroding independence. I think in the advanced economies, I mean, I agree with Isabel, it depends how persistent this supply-driven inflation is. If it passes, then it is transitory, as most advanced economy central banks seem to think, then I think the independence is not so threatened. But if it is more persistent, then I think the kind of trilemma that she described of you're doing these very loose monetary policies, you're having all these spillover effects, and you're still not delivering your inflation target, it becomes a bit of a problem. And I think central banks were able to hold on to their independence because they were so successful for so many decades at delivering the inflation target. I mean, it has been one of the biggest policy successes that we have seen in the last 30 years. And so I do think that's the key to this dilemma.
It's sobering we've ended this way, but I guess I should also record that we started off thinking about whether the job should be bigger than originally intended. And we've ended up worrying most about whether central banks can continue to do their core job. And I guess we should also record that this has not been a problem that we have talked about very much in these kind of conversations for quite a long time. And maybe that's a sign of some kind of progress. It's been fantastic. And we could carry on for many more hours. But thank you so much to Hélène for helping to bring together, Hélène Rey, for bringing together people in this conference all day. And especially to Isabel Schnabel and Carmen Reinhardt and Minouche Baroness Shafiq for this great conversation. That's it for this special Womenomics edition of Stephanomics. We'll be back to normal next week with the curious case of the missing US worker, among other things. Join us then. And in the meantime, if you like the programme, please do rate it. And follow @Economics on Twitter for more news and analysis from Bloomberg Economics. This episode was produced by Magnus Henriksen, with special thanks to the Centre for Economic Policy Research and especially Professor Hélène Rey for inviting me to that joint conference with the European Central Bank. Also to Baroness Minouche Shafiq, Dr. Carmen Reinhardt and Dr. Isabel Schnabel. Mike Sasso is executive producer of Stephanomics and the head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy.